This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer and healthier and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. We spend thousands of hours watching movies. We love stories, but when I ask people what they learned from a movie, I get a deer in the headlight. What gives? Movies have a tremendous influence on us. Superman and Rocky, you just feel powerful. All you have to do is hear the music, and you feel powerful. You watch a Fred Astaire movie, or Saturday Night Fever, or Flashdance, you feel like dancing. So if they're having such a big influence on us, what are we learning from the movies? Can movies teach us how to live longer and healthier and happier? Indeed, I'm so excited about movies, I often use them when I do coaching or therapy. If somebody is holding back and not going for it, I might tell them to watch a movie like Defending Your Life, and then let's talk about it. I'm also fascinated with movies because they're a shared consciousness. If 100 people who had never seen Gone with the Wind read the book, there would be 100 different versions of what Rhett Butler was like and what Scarlett was like. But once you've seen the movie, Rhett can only be Clark Gable, and Scarlett can only be Olivia de Havilland, and so we speak a common language. Our guest today is a movie critic, also a photographer, Brent Marchant, author of Get the Picture. Brent thinks movies have a lot to teach us, and he likes to focus on conscious creation, the idea that we create our own reality. We'll get into that more later. Brent, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me on the show.
When I see the movie theaters, almost everybody going are teenagers and young adults. It's date night. Are the directors and producers making the movies specifically for those audiences?
Well, it depends to a certain extent on the time of year. During the summer, there's a lot of emphasis put on the action-adventure, special effects extravaganza, blockbuster-type films. And that period usually goes from about the beginning of May until around Labor Day. Once you get past Labor Day, then you start getting into the pictures that are being more seriously considered for award consideration, like the Oscars and the Golden Globes. So you tend to see maybe a bit more serious or more substantive-type fare that comes out from that point to the end of the year, because everybody's vying for getting the nominations for those awards. It's basically a two-season year.
No idea about that, so it's not just for kids.
No.
We have all these different genres of movies. We've got romance and crime and war and good versus evil and teen movies and titillation movies and sci-fi and comedy. Do those have different agendas in what the directors are trying to teach us?
I think basically every director's got a different agenda for what they're trying to do. Some of it may be related to the message of the film. Some may be related to where they want to take their career, basically.
Uh-huh.
It all really depends upon the particular circumstance.
In today's program, I want to focus on what we can learn about living longer, healthier, and happier. So the first place I looked was role models. I'm a big believer in role models. That's why I talk about centenarians who are doing incredible things so much, because they're role models. When I looked at the movies for role models of how to live well when you're 70, 80, 90, 100, boy, the picking seemed awful slim. Did you find many examples?
That's unfortunate. Many times when movies are made, they are focused more toward at least middle-aged to younger viewers. And I think they're missing out on quite a few opportunities by doing that. I have found that in Europe, there's a little bit more emphasis placed on casting older characters in films than you see in the States. It's been a little bit slow to catch on here, but hopefully at some point the population in this country tends to age with baby boomers getting older. Maybe the producers in this country will realize that they're missing out on a target audience if they don't start having more movies with characters that are from that age group.
So there's better pickings among the foreign films, and things will probably get better.
That's what I'm hoping for.
One positive character that I saw was Maude in Harold and Maude.
Oh, yes.
She just had such a zest for life. Does she have much to teach us?
She really does. She's very vivacious. She's very active. She's got a positive spin and outlook on life. And she also knows when it's time to let go of things as well. So when you put that combination together, it's really very, very healthy outlook on life in terms of living for the moment, making the most of every moment that you have, and trying to use that to as a pattern or a template for how you govern your life in general.
She loved life, but she wasn't afraid of death and even chose when she was going to die.
Yes.
Another character that most people haven't seen is Miss Marple. This is a frumpy English woman who lives life on her terms, but when it comes to solving mysteries, she's smarter than all the British police force and always solved the mystery. Her counterpart that people do know is Angela Lansbury on Murder, She Wrote. Have you seen many of the Miss Marple movies?
I've seen a few. I haven't seen a great many of them, but I have seen a number of Murder, She Wrote episodes over the years.
Is there a lot to learn from that?
I think one of the things that's really important with almost any type of effective story, but in the case of a character like Miss Marple or Angela Lansbury's character, you see someone who is making an effort to stay sharp and to pay attention and to keep the mind active, which I think is really very important for people as they age, simply because otherwise it's very easy for the mind to turn to jello.
So these people have the belief that you need to keep your mind sharp, and you do it by using your mind and challenging your mind.
Yes, and the belief what you just mentioned is really very critical when it comes to understanding how the practice of conscious creation works, mainly because it's your beliefs that will govern the reality that you create for yourself. Basically, what you're putting out is what you get back. So it's very important for each of us to understand where we're coming from, what we're thinking, what we're believing, because everything that we're going to see in the reality around us is going to be a reflection of that.
I think Moonstruck, which is one of my favorite movies, nicely illustrates that in that we have love for all ages. The aunt and her husband were just such a lovely elderly couple. It just warms your hearts to see how affectionate they are toward each other. And then you have Olivia Dukakis's character when the younger man takes her to dinner and hits on her. She says, I can't do that because I know who I am. So we have a very different kind of reality there.
Yes, we do. That self-awareness, that self-knowledge is so critical in terms of being able to get the kind of reality that you want to get, because the more you're in tune with where it is that you're coming from, the more likely you're going to end up getting what it is that you want. You're going to recognize the value of what you've got, and you're going to appreciate the importance of it in your life. Also, it'll tell you when you need to make changes. If you need to start altering your beliefs in some particular direction, your reality will give you a very clear indicator to say, this isn't working, or this is working.
And Olivia Dukakis's character is a nice example of that, because she was smart enough not to let the flattery of a younger man suck her in to something that was contrary to who she was.
Exactly.
But she put down her fist at the dinner table and told her husband to stop having affairs, and she was so forceful about it that he said, okay.
And he was also smart enough to realize, don't give up a good thing when you've got it.
Well, I'm really stretching for positive role models. Does Yoda have anything to teach us?
Oh, Yoda has a lot to teach us. In so many ways, the role that he played in The Empire Strikes Back is so prototypical of what it's like to learn about the process of conscious creation, using your mind to direct the results that you get out of life. He's also very positive at one point where he says to Luke Skywalker, don't try, do, which I think is really so important. I think so many times we end up not getting the reality that we want out of our lives simply because we're spending so much time trying to get what we want rather than actually doing it.
Words are so important. In hypnosis, one of the tricks that we do, I shouldn't call it a trick, but you know, we'll say your hands are bonded together with crazy glue, and no matter how hard you try to pull them apart, you won't be able to. Go ahead and try, because the word try suggests that you're not going to succeed. So whenever I hear somebody use the word try, I say, uh-oh. You know?
Exactly. It's really a case of setting yourself up for coming up short, because you are automatically building in a hedge against getting the result that you want to get.
So we could either read up on conscious creation, or we could just say, how do I think like Yoda and get the same results?
Well, that's certainly, thinking like Yoda is a very good starting point, because he gives you a lot of key indicators in terms of how to proceed.
Another role model I curiously came up with was God. George Burns is God. He's just so, you just like him so much. And Morgan Freeman, what gravitas. Great role models?
Oh, absolutely. The power of belief comes out so strongly in connection with George Burns' God character, because at one point when John Denver asks him, can I have your business card, and he hands it to him and it just says God on it. Having the ultimate test of beliefs in your faith in terms of a higher power to help guide you through, what more does God have to do to elaborate on his business card than just say, here's who I am?
Mm.
We could all have that kind of self-confidence in our self-awareness of who we are, as the George Burns character does. I think a lot of us would be a lot happier because we'd be a lot clearer about ourselves.
And what makes Morgan Freeman so appealing?
I think his plain-spokenness, as much as anything, his warmth, and there's a genuine sense of loving behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Things that we talk about sometimes in conscious creation is a concept called the safe universe, where basically anything that comes along in our lives, no matter seemingly how challenging or daunting it might be, it's there for our growth, and it really ultimately is not really meant to hurt us. It's meant to help us grow. It's meant to help us become better, stronger, more evolved people.
So treat it as a lesson instead of a disaster.
Exactly. It's like look for the silver lining or look for the lemonade out of the lemons instead of just bemoaning, what is this? What's this all about? If I have something that comes along in my life that seemingly seems like a speed bump or a left turn that is not what I was probably hoping for, I've made a practice of making the first question I ask myself, okay, why did I draw this to me?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good starting point because it sort of diffuses a lot of the emotional power that comes with it that might potentially get you caught up in, you know, a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of distress that just keeps you from getting the lesson, keeps you from learning what it is you're meant to learn from it, and keeps you from moving forward.
There's two issues there. The one is, what can I learn from this? The other is, how did I draw this to me? Sticking with the first one, I'm amazed at how many people who maybe were a prisoner of war will say, you know, I wouldn't want to go through that again, but I'm so glad it happened to me. I wouldn't change that about my life. And I've even seen people who are paralyzed, quadriplegic, paraplegic, who say the same thing, that this has been a real blessing in my life.
Absolutely. I have a personal experience of my own where, ironically, I was on my way to a conscious creation conference one time when I became ill and was put into the hospital. And at least initially a little bit disappointed in the fact that I wasn't getting to go to the conference because I was looking forward to attending and seeing friends. But there were so many lessons that came out of that experience that I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Mm-hmm. One of the most fascinating movies about aging is Cocoon, and when it was made in 1985, the idea of living forever was an academic exercise. But now, people will find it hard to believe, but it's possible that quite a few people listening to our broadcast might actually live for hundreds of years or who knows how long. And it's not that science has to come up with the solution next year or even 10 years, but the way science is evolving so fast, you make it 10 more years in reasonably good health, and the technology is there to get us another 10 years, and it's just a matter of time before genetic engineering and tissue engineering makes this a real possibility. What do you think of Cocoon?
Oh, I thought Cocoon was a wonderful picture. I really enjoyed it. It was a great example, again, of people who were keeping young at heart, keeping positive images in their mind, and also even turning their beliefs around to a certain extent, because when the movie began, actually some of them didn't have the most positive outlooks about the way things were going to go in their future. But once they discovered their own personal fountain of youth, turned everything around for them in terms of how they lived their lives, how they viewed their future, and how they were going to use the time that they had available to them.
What's the difference between the character who chose not to go in the spaceship and live forever, but to stay with what he knew and live out his life?
I think a lot of it really comes down to a question of beliefs. He was not willing to change his beliefs. He stayed where he was, whereas everybody else was willing to alter theirs and make adjustments and make changes to give them the kind of life that they wanted to create for themselves going forward. And that's really a very important component in conscious creation, the idea that you're not stuck with your choices. So many times I'll hear people say things like, I didn't have any choice in the matter, or I couldn't do anything about it. Well, as long as we're creatures of free will, we always have choices. And that means, by contrast, then, that we always have the ability to change as well. So that if we're in circumstances that we're not happy with, we can always move to new ones to get the results we want to get.
I don't mean this flippantly. Is conscious creation kind of a do-it-yourself therapy?
In some ways, it really does force an individual to get very close to understanding what his or her particular beliefs are. It really does involve coming to have a good understanding of oneself. I think that's probably one of the greatest gifts that comes out of it, is that when you see the reality that you have around you and you try to figure out why it is, you also start to figure out a lot of things about yourself, some of which you may have been aware of and some of which you may not have been aware of. And that's important, because if you start to come across things that you're not happy with, you might say to yourself, well, I don't like that, I want to change it. So it gives you a very good starting point as a springboard to make the kinds of alterations in your beliefs and consequently in the reality that you've got around you.
What were the roots of conscious creation? Was it built upon certain philosophies or philosophers?
Some people call it a new idea, some people call it an old idea. In many ways, some of the roots of it could be probably traced back as far as the ancient practice of alchemy. Most people think of that just as a process of changing metal, but a lot of the people who practiced it in old times realized that they had to be part of the process. If they weren't putting themselves into it, they weren't going to get the result that they want. So in many ways, while they may have been outwardly looking to try and change metal, they were also trying to change themselves in many ways. They were taking lead and turning it into gold, not only literally, but also figuratively in terms of their own personalities and their own personal outlooks on life.
I don't think alchemy is going to sell it very well, because for most people, alchemy is associated with a hoax or at least something that failed. What other roots were there?
That's one of the roots. Even when you look at a lot of religious texts and so forth throughout the centuries, and you hear about prophets like Jesus performing miracles and so forth, a lot of it comes down to the notion that they believed that they could do it to begin with. Well, if those people believe that they could do it, who's to say that somebody else couldn't do it as well?
Or at least it puts you on the path of, if it's doable, let me figure out how to do it.
Exactly. So many times people will say there's no miracles anymore, and yet you look at so many wonderful things that happen in people's lives that seemingly turn things around so dramatically. If that's not a miracle, I don't know what is. There might not be clouds parting and horns blaring when it happens, but to me, that doesn't make it any less a miracle.
And how many people have you heard about that were pronounced terminally ill, given a few months to live, and it's years later, and they're a model of health?
Oh, sure. There have been so many anecdotal cases of people who've responded to the placebo effect or who have had spontaneous remissions and so forth, and medical practitioners have been standing there scratching their heads saying, how did this happen? Well, they made some kind of change in their life. They brought it about. And that may have been directed toward just doing their own efforts, or it may have been working in conjunction with a higher power, you know, involving prayer, meditation, any number of those things. But they all consciously created a different outcome from what all the experts were projecting that they were supposed to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Let me take us back to Cocoon. I kept thinking about, what is the mindset of the people who did go for it? What were their beliefs? Is it that you just go for it in life, or this is a deal that's too good to pass up, or I'm avoiding the pain of disability and dying? What's your best guess?
Oh, I think a lot of it had to do with taking the adventure. They weren't ready to give up on where they were in their lives, so they decided to move forward and try new routes. I was also very taken with a quote that Wilfred Brimley said at one point, where he said that, I think life has cheated us at a number of times, so I don't mind cheating it back a little bit. So it's taking the bull by the horns and taking the responsibility for shaping the kind of destiny for himself that he wanted to create. And I think that's another key concept. Conscious creation is the notion of responsibility. When you set out to create your own reality, there's a lot of power in that. And with that power comes a great deal of responsibility to shape it in a way that brings you the result that you want, that's not going to harm others, that hopefully is going to help others to reach a very positive result that they want for themselves as well.
So in Cocoon, we had all the characters taking responsibility, and the mere prospect of the adventure woke them up and got them excited long before they went on the spaceship.
Sure. Don Amici did. He went into his bank, closed his account, and started passing out the money. I mean, he was sharing his happiness with others by doing for other people in ways that they might not have been able to have done for themselves, so he was making life a little bit better for them.
Another aging challenge is that we get in our 40s or 50s or whatever, and we say, gee, I haven't conquered the world, I haven't been as successful as I hoped, I didn't make my mark on the world. And to me, the movie for that message is A Wonderful Life. What does that movie teach us?
A lot of times it teaches us that we need to take a look at our lives very critically to realize exactly the contributions that we're making. George Bailey's character wanted to go out and build all these tremendous structures like bridges and airports and skyscrapers and so forth, and thought that that would be the best way that he could make a contribution to life by building all these huge monuments. And yet at the same time, by offering people affordable housing to people who ordinarily would not have been able to get it, he was making a tremendous accomplishment just by doing that, but he couldn't see it. So the important thing in that movie is to really come to see what it is that we're doing as individuals and the contributions that we're making, because a lot of times we may be selling ourselves short and not even realize it.
And the epiphany was nothing had changed in reality, and yet everything changed when he changed his perception of it.
Absolutely.
And then that in turn energized him to go out and stand up to the gentleman that owned the hometown.
Oh, Mr. Potter.
Yes.
It would have been interesting to see what would have happened to George in a sequel. Like, what would have happened to George once he had realized what kind of contributions he was making, what kinds of power he was wielding so masterfully and using to such beneficial uses. What would he have been able to accomplish after that? And that would have made, I think, a very fascinating story.
So if you were writing the sequel, what would you have happen?
Well, I'm not going to try and touch the masters. I just posed the question because I thought it was an interesting idea.
Not going to compete with Frank Capra, huh?
No. I couldn't begin to do that.
There's an interesting piece of trivia about that movie. The original black and white movie is out of copyright, which is probably one of the reasons we see it so often. The colorized version is copyrighted, and the television stations have to pay every time they run that.
They should save their money.
Oh, yes. What an abomination to colorize that movie or most any other movie. Well, another aging challenge, Who Am I, gets us to probably my all-time favorite movie, Groundhog Day. Most of us, every day, we see the same family members, we go to work, we see the same people, and we do basically the same things most days. Groundhog Day reminds me of Thomas Edison saying he tried thousands of things that didn't work before he found what did work. What can we learn from Groundhog Day?
One of the things I find most fascinating about Groundhog Day is that he essentially gets to try out his life almost like a test kitchen to see what recipe is going to work. And he has the same circumstances available to him each day so that he can choose to see, is this particular aspect of what I'm trying to do going to fit into it or not? Doesn't work, he gets the same circumstances the next day to try something different, and so on and so forth, until he finally gets it right.
And when he gets it right, it's not just being a little more effective, it changes his whole identity, who he chooses as friends, where he wants to live, what he wants to do with his life.
He literally shifts his entire reality by doing it, but that's because he has shifted internally first. He's changed his beliefs, he's changed his perspective and outlook, so that he's able to put himself into a different reality from where he began. When you see the transformation that he goes through in the movie, it's pretty tremendous, considering that he starts out as this really very snarly sort of curmudgeon and ends up as this very warm and lovable person.
So if we wanted to learn from this movie, we could literally say to ourselves, you know, I'm going to take one day and just look at every little transaction and do it a little differently.
Taking each day to look at one thing is a very good starting point. It may be a little difficult to try and take it all on at once, but at least tackling one thing at a time, saying, how do I want to do this differently? How do I want to handle myself in order to achieve a different result from what I've been getting because I haven't liked what I've been getting? That should put the focus squarely back on you and, from the conscious creation perspective, squarely on what beliefs that you're putting out in the first place that are getting you the results that you're either happy or not happy with.
Brent, have you personally experimented with this test kitchen approach at a kind of a micro level?
Many times.
And
many times.
What did you find?
Sometimes you will get changes that occur in a huge quantum leap fashion all at once, and other times you need to do continual tweaking till you get the result that you want. And a lot of that comes down to, again, how well you know yourself.
If it's not too personal, can you think of an example where you got a big change from one of those little tweaks?
Probably in the area of personal finances.
Mm-hmm.
When I really came to understand where some of my beliefs were coming from, I realized that they were coming from a source that no longer served me, and yet I had been holding on to it for a very long time. And once I became aware of that, I said, no, I'm going to change that belief. Within a matter of months, the financial situation turned around drastically.
What was the old belief?
The old belief had to do with the idea that money is hard to come by and you don't get to keep most of what you get. And I grew up the child of Depression-era parents, and I know they went through a tremendous struggle during that time when they were growing up. And that was one of the beliefs that they tended to impart on me as I was growing up. And it was a little strange because I looked around myself, and by that point, they had become relatively successful. And I said, these two don't fit. So there was kind of a disconnect in terms of where my beliefs were in regard to that.
So you grew up like George Bailey.
In many ways, yeah. And as a result, many years later, I began to realize that those were their beliefs. They weren't mine. And the experience I had growing up really didn't line up with the same kind of experience they had growing up. And yet, I was still holding on to the beliefs that they had given to me. So I said, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make any sense. That's not where I'm at, and that's not where I want to be. So let's get rid of it. And when I did, like I say, things changed within a matter of a couple months.
Wonderful. We're talking with Brent Marchant, author of Get the Picture. Brent is, by the way, also a photographer, which ties in very nicely with his love of movies. Get the Picture, it's not the usual Siskel and Ebert kind of reviews. It's looking at pictures from the point of view of how they can help you change your life.
Say it's as much a book of philosophy as it is a book about film. You're getting essentially two for the price of one, a double feature.
There you go. You can find Get the Picture at Amazon.com and major bookstores, at the publisher's website, momentpoint.com. That's momentpoint.com. And Brent, you have a blog, Get the Picture, Brent Marchant, blogspot.com. Boy, that's
yes.
A lot.
That is a long one. Yeah, there's no spaces and no underscores in that.
So it was Get the Picture, Brent, B-R-E-N-T, Marchant, M-A-R-C-H-A-N-T .blogspot.com. And if you can't remember that, you can always go to agelesslifestyles.com and check the posting on this show, and I'll have all the websites that we talked about. Back to the movies. One of the aging challenges is relationships with parents, and I think we're starting to see a flurry of these movies because our producers and directors are baby boomers getting to the age where they're struggling with these issues. We're seeing movies like On Golden Pond. Brent, does that have much to teach us?
Golden Pond is very good in terms of helping us to show the nature of the relationship between the children and the parents, to see where it was, see where it is now, and to see potentially where it might be going down the road. And it's particularly crucial given the fact that the parents are quite elderly in the movie and they may not be around a whole lot longer. Giving the younger characters a chance to see what kind of relationship do I want to have with them, what kind of beliefs do I hold about the relationship, am I going to hold on to perhaps the idea of old resentments,
mm-hmm.
or do I want to change that so I have the time and the opportunity to do that.
And even with, say, Henry Fonda's character, where because of some senility he's not able to make a lot of changes, we still see changes in the relationship.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a case when you're talking family ties, they tend to be very strong. And even though you may have some impediments creeping in and having effects on how the relationship is going, there's still an underlying strength because you've been around these people all of your life that you want to try to forge the kind of relationship that you want to get out of it while you still have the chance to do it.
Were there any other parent relationship movies that you particularly liked?
Ordinary People. You have a case of children and parents who are in so many ways so out of touch with each other and going through a great deal of anguish and agony over their particular circumstances. And yet, when you see some flashbacks that go back into the distant past with this family, there is a tremendous wellspring of love. They're searching for ways to get back to it, searching to find the connections that they had lost as a result of some personal tragedies that went on in the family as the children had gotten older. The struggle that you see them go through to get a handle on what it is they believe, what it is they think they should believe, what beliefs they need to let go of to be able to get back to where they were. It's just tremendous to watch the story of people working under such tremendously dire circumstances.
And you look at Mary Tyler Moore's character and you say, man, they're never going to crack her. I mean, how in the world are they going to get her to come along?
Absolutely. But a wonderful movie. Just a wonderful movie. And it's interesting, too, because there's a psychiatrist relationship in the movie also involving the one teenage son. In many ways, that speaks back to conscious creation, too, because the psychiatrist is pushing the character to come to know himself, to come to see mm-hmm. what his beliefs are. And again, that's very much the kind of thing that goes on in conscious creation, to come to know yourself, because the better you do, the more you'll be happy with yourself.
That whole movie was about beliefs and interpretations and how shifting them changed everything and got rid of a lot of pain.
And also, too, how you sometimes need to go below the surface, just the outward perceptions that you're seeing of a particular situation, to get to the root of it. Because a lot of times what you're seeing on the surface isn't necessarily what's being fully intended underneath. It involves really learning how to tune into your intuition, which is very important in terms of how we shape our beliefs, because it plays a tremendous role, and we sometimes tend to downplay it. We might look at it as being perhaps irrational or unreasonable,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's playing a major role. Until we have a good understanding of that, we might not have a very good understanding of what our beliefs really are.
Another aging challenge is having a sense of purpose, and this is a big one for me, because my take is that 50 years ago, you grew up on a farm, you lived in the same community, you went to the same church all your life, you knew you were going to be a farmer when you grew up. There was very little change in what your purpose was. You knew it. Now, with people staying with jobs only a few years or several years and moving all over the country and marriages not lasting long, we're constantly having to readjust our purpose. So I look to movies to see, can they tell us about purpose when we get older? And we had some very mediocre movies, but still some messages there. And I'm thinking of Koch, Going in Style, and Grumpy Old Men.
Those are all fine examples of that. I think the most important thing in terms of understanding our purpose is to really get in touch with who we are, the roles that we play in other people's lives. And I think a very good movie for that is the movie Being There,
mm-hmm.
with Peter Sellers. So interesting, because he's so, in many ways, almost unaware of what he's doing in terms of the purpose that he's fulfilling, and yet he is giving each and every one of the characters in their lives exactly what they need. And he's doing it just by being his own humble, innocent little self.
That's a wonderful movie, and it certainly has this effect on other people, but does the Chauncey Gardner character himself have anything to offer us as a role model?
Well, the main thing I would say is really just being yourself. He's quite clearly giving back to everybody the thing that they need most in their lives, and that is a tremendous role just in and of itself. The idea of being of service to others by helping them to get the things that they need for themselves. And the thing is, in turn, he ends up getting all the things that he needs. He's facing a situation when the movie begins where he's going to be without a home, he's going to be without anybody to take care of him, and he ends up living in a mansion.
And it's very much like Forrest Gump.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Those two movies are, in that respect, are very similar.
The three movies I mentioned, in Koch, Walter Matthau finds purpose from helping out a young pregnant girl. In Going in Style, we've got older men who are just bored to death sitting on the park bench until they decide to rob a bank, and that gives them purpose in life, although not a good purpose. And then Grumpy Old Men, we have Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon who are stuck in a rut until Anne Margaret shows up. Matter of fact, when I do corporate presentations, I'll say the solution to Grumpy Old Men in the workplace is to have Anne Margaret come in, but she's a little expensive, and especially if you have continuity of having her come back every few months.
Or if you have a lot of women in the company.
Yeah, they're right. They want George Clooney, so you have a double expense. I can do it for a lot less. So what Hollywood is telling us is that having a sense of purpose is critical to having a good life when you get older.
Yes, I absolutely do believe that. And in many ways, that also goes back to Maude, too, we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she has a purpose of bringing joy into people's lives. That might not be something that you put on a resume or that you collect a salary for, but certainly its value and its purpose in life is no less important.
I had never thought of this before, but you just gave me the idea. On a resume, why not put some testimonials that how the person changed their life or what a good person it was? I mean, I've never seen testimonials on a resume. Why not?
I think it's a great idea, and not only just in terms of the testimonials, but also in terms of talking about what you can bring to an organization or people's lives from a personal standpoint.
And if you were applying for a job that has dozens and dozens of applicants, that would help you stand out.
Absolutely. You know, especially if you're going into something like a service industry, where the notion of the personal connection is so important, and it's something that I think that people are feeling very disconnected from these days, particularly when you go to do almost anything over the phone, it's all automated now. That loss of personal contact is something that I think people are really feeling is missing. So if you can bring that into people's lives, sure, I think that's a great idea, and hey, why not put it on the resume? Let people find out right up front who it is they're dealing with before they hire them.
I love it. Well, another one of the aging challenges is dealing with death. As we get older, people we care about are going to die, and if it throws us, if we get depressed, then we become vulnerable to illnesses, and we get in this very negative spiral. We've got things like Love Story. How sappy can you get? I get nauseous just thinking about that movie. Are there some good movies that tell us about how to cope with death?
There are so many different ways of approaching it, and I think it all comes down to a personal choice in terms of how you want to look at it. But to have movies that have a more positive spin, something like, say, The Bucket List, which was not the greatest movie in the world, but in terms of making the most of the time that you have left.
Tell us a little bit about that movie for people who don't know it.
It's two characters who find out that they're suffering from illness and their days are numbered, and they decide to go out and pursue all the things that they had never done in life while they still have the chance to do it, all the grand adventures that they had talked about doing and never did. And this is a chance for them to try them out while they still have the chance.
A do-it-yourself Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yeah, exactly. There are also movies like Tuesdays with Maury.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, which takes a much more philosophical approach to it. There are movies like All That Jazz, which gives a character a chance to say, what did I do right, what did I do wrong, what do I wish I had done more of?
Boy, I had so many problems with that movie. The music and the dance and everything were absolutely fabulous and captivating, and yet what the character was doing was so self-destructive, I found it very disturbing.
It was self-destructive, but it was giving him a chance to really see it with the rose-colored glasses off. It was sort of right in his face of, okay, you've lived your life, and now it's time for you to review. What do you make of it? What do you think of it? Which is, I think, important, because if you are somebody who believes that our consciousness survives death and moves on and perhaps reincarnates, you want to have, I think, a good assessment of how you spend a particular life as part of the knowledge of your consciousness as you move forward into perhaps whatever your next adventure is going to be. Do you want to do the same things over again? Do you want to do something differently?
And All That Jazz was like the opera Don Giovanni. It was all put before him, what an evil life he had lived, and he said, I don't care.
But he had created so many tremendous pieces of theater and film, and he had given people a lot of joy at the same time, so it was sort of a mixed bag in many ways for him.
The other movie that fascinated me about dealing with death was just a little clip from Little Big Man, where Chief Dan George says, it's a good day to die, and walks off into the woods. Talk about a person not being afraid of death and deciding he'd done everything that he'd wanted to do.
There's actually a number of movies that are very good in terms of addressing things like that, and even though it's not necessarily dealing with death per se, but science fiction movie Starman, where the character comes to Earth and spends a brief incarnation living a life as a physical human. When his time comes for him to leave, he walks away and says, okay, I'm ready to go, and I'm grateful for having had the experience, no matter how short it may have been.
My role model for that is teachers. You get a class of kids, you get very close to them, you spend a whole year, and then you have to let go and move on to the next crop.
Yes.
And teachers do that so well.
Yes. And students do, too.
Mm-hmm. I think that's built into the expectation, whereas when it comes to people dying, we never got a good expectation and system for handling that.
Probably because in so many ways it's been misunderstood. I mean, I remember my parents had a pretty good handle on it. They never tried to shield me from going to wakes or going to funerals or things like that. But so many people I grew up with were faced with situations of that death is something that you don't talk about, or you talk about it in very hushed tones, or you don't talk about it in front of the children. I think it's left a lot of people ill-prepared for how to face it, and that's unfortunate because it's something we're all going to go through. So I think it's important that there are movies like this out there that show us that it is part of life and that there are different ways of handling it. That certainly the ones that are most suitable for one particular person's sensibilities is just the inspiration that they can draw from when they come to approach it for themselves.
I think you're dead on, no pun intended, about being out of touch with death because of how we handle funerals. They used to literally have the casket sitting in the living room and everyone would come over and have something to eat. Now we have this very sanitized experience in a funeral home, and so many people have gotten away from their religious traditions that spelled out how to handle it, how to let go, so we're lost.
One of the things that I've really been very inspired by have been the New Orleans funerals.
Mm.
The jazz parade, and the festival atmosphere, and the party. I mean, if this is supposed to be a celebration of a person's life, I've already told people that when it comes my time, I want to party. It's just kind of the way I've always approached life to begin with anyhow. What better way to end it?
I have a whole bunch of other aging challenges I'd like to get into, but we only have time for one more, so I'm going to choose finding mentors. We've got God being a mentor, we've got angels being a mentor, we've got, I'm sure, one of your favorites, Star Wars. One of my favorites is Play It Again, Sam. What did you think about having an imaginary character teach us how to live a better life?
Certainly any source that's going to inspire us to live us the kind of life that we want to lead is a good thing, I think. And Woody Allen's character is such the clumsy buffoon in so many ways, and yet here he's dealing with the ultimate cool guy in Bogey. What better way to try and become the person you want to become? And especially since Bogey's character, he doesn't hesitate to tell him exactly what he's thinking either.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's the best kind of mentor we can have, is somebody who's not going to sugarcoat things, who's going to slap us in the face and say, hey, wake up. Get your beliefs in order.
And what's fascinating about the process there is he was such a huge fan of Bogey. He knew exactly what Bogey would say and everything, but he was objective enough to stand back and let Bogey, in the theater of his mind, say what he needed to hear rather than what he wished Bogey would
Absolutely.
Say. And that was what enabled him to make the changes and become the character, well, starting to get as much depth as Bogey.
It also enabled him to eventually let go of the mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the other things, too, I think, that is equally important with the mentor, is understanding that they come into our lives to play a role, to plant some seeds, help us put some particular beliefs into place, and then to move on, to let us take over
mm-hmm.
at that point. Because otherwise they just become some kind of emotional crutch that we hold on to, and consequently our beliefs never change and we never grow.
Brent, is Star Wars the ultimate mentor movie?
It's certainly one of the best, and it's certainly one of the most classic. It draws from so many mythological traditions, and the mythological traditions are certainly among the best for helping to convey those kinds of big ideas, like growing as a result of having contact with a mentor, sure.
How have you personally used mentors from Star Wars to help you with your life or using conscious creation?
Probably from just learning how to use the Force. When I saw Star Wars for the very first time when it came out, a lot of my spiritual and religious thinking at that point was very clouded. I had an upbringing that was not very fulfilling or very satisfying for me in that regard. And when I watched Star Wars and learned about the concept of the Force, it just resonated with me on such a gut level. I just said to myself, that's it. I don't fully understand it yet or get a grasp of where this is going to take me, but I know this is where it's at. And in many ways, very similar to the notion of how we function with the divine source in our lives when we make use of conscious creation. You know, we put the idea out, and then the divine force helps us step in and help us to see it through, to realize it. And the Force works very much the same way. Luke puts out the idea of what it is he wants to achieve. The Force comes to his cooperation and helps to bring it forward.
And to summarize conscious creation, you just mentioned two of the principles, the law of attraction and the idea of some kind of force in the universe that can provide. The other two elements that come to me are believing that you create your own reality and a focus on beliefs and changing beliefs as a means of improving your life.
Yes, I'd say those are the major core principles that are involved in it. The DVD of The Secret, which came out about a little bit over a year ago,
mm-hmm.
does a very good job of explaining how it works in terms of showing that it's like shopping the catalog of the universe. You put out your intention to the universe, this is what I would like to achieve, and I believe it's possible, now please bring it to me. And that's where the universe kind of steps in and takes over and ends up bringing it back to you. Now, the one thing that's very important in that is, again, being very clear on your belief, because you may end up not stating it perhaps as precisely as you would like, and you may end up getting the result that you said that you wanted, but it might not necessarily take the form that you want.
It's like the old be careful what you wish for riddles and jokes.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's why it's very critical to be very clear with the intents that you're putting out with your beliefs.
We've been talking with Brent Marchant, author of Get the Picture. Since you have such a long blog title, I'll just refer people to agelesslifestyles.com to find that. You can find his book, Get the Picture, at either the publisher's website, momentpoint.com, which also has other conscious creation books, or at Amazon or major bookstores. Brent, it's been great fun talking with you, and I learned a lot, and I think both of us changed our resumes.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk to your listeners about the book.
Wonderful. Well, it's time for commentary. With this show, I set off on an adventure. I didn't know where it would lead, but my instincts told me that movies had a lot to teach us, and Brent was the perfect person to help us do it. Brent would probably say, "The Force was with me." I hope you found it as rewarding as I did. I know I got a much richer understanding of both the role of movies and also some particular movies and why they are so engaging and appealing and have so much to offer. It's interesting that Brent and I both have genres of movies that we love and genres that we pay little or no attention to. Brett, for example, loves sci-fis, but has little use for westerns, horror movies, musicals, and I gather not a very strong interest in crime and war movies. While I should be interested in sci-fi because they often deal with beliefs and belief changes, to me, most of them are just westerns in outer space, and only a few really capture my imagination. I have no interest in westerns and horror movies, and a war movie or a crime movie has to be very good or have some real psychological depth to it for me to be interested in it. Unlike Brett, I love a good musical. Just as the soundtracks are very powerful, when the character bursts into a song that's just an absolute perfect fit with the emotions that they're pouring out, it goes straight to the heart. So what's genre mean? It means go with what you love. Go with what appeals to you because that's what's going to hook in and capture your imagination and give you the messages that you need. I also have a special place in my heart for what I call what-if movies, like Groundhog Day or Joe versus the Volcano, and what I call chutzpah movies, movies in which the characters are audacious, such as Trading Places, in which Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy turn the tables on the Wall Street moguls, Used Cars, in which the salesman has no shame and ends up running for a political office, and Catch Me If You Can, in which Leonardo DiCaprio enacts the real-life story of a counterfeiter who was absolutely amazing. Brent and I differed on role models. He is fascinated with any movie in which a role model has interesting beliefs. I'm really looking for role models we can emulate. Thus, he liked being there, whereas I saw Chauncey Gardner's having not much for us to model. He liked Roy Scheider's character and All That Jazz. I saw him as failing to learn anything and very disturbing a role model. For that reason, I have little interest in movies like The Godfather in that these are not people I want to model. There's a fascination with power, but I don't think that's a healthy fascination. Call me prudish, but I think the more we watch movies like Godfather or TV programs like Sopranos, the more we're tempted to emulate, and those are not people to emulate. What can we make of conscious creation? I once saw a skit on TV in which a dentist did the movie reviews. For every movie, it was what the main character's teeth were like. Did it have a gap? Did they have an overbite, etc.? Brent sees every movie from the prism of conscious creation. Like a professor, it seems to me sometimes he makes it a little more work than it needs to be. To review the principles of conscious creation, first we have the idea that you create your own reality. I think there's a continuum to which people believe this. Most people believe it at least to some extent. So it's a matter of degree. When you take it to its farthest extreme, you get a scene like in one of the airplane movies where they said, well, you bought the ticket, you're responsible for the fact that this plane's likely to crash. If we feel responsible for everything we touch, it can feel like a tremendous burden on us. So maybe we need to apply Aristotle's principle of all things in moderation. When you take things to an extreme, you tend to run into more problems. Second, we have the law of attraction. What you focus your mind on is what you tend to attract, whether it's good or bad. We certainly see this with when you get a new car. Suddenly you see that make and model of car everywhere. We also see the principle of attraction. Women who marry alcoholics get a divorce, marry another alcoholic, likewise abusive husbands. Whether you believe in universal forces or not, there's a lot to be said for what you focus on is what you tend to attract. That said, just really focusing on how badly you want to win the lottery doesn't mean that you're going to win the lottery, especially if you don't buy a ticket. Or as your grandmother probably said, just wishing doesn't make it so. So the law of attraction has to be paired with doing the things that also facilitate what it is you want and what it is you're focusing on. If that woman who divorced the abusive alcoholic gets lonely one night and goes to a bar, it's far more likely to happen again than if she goes to the Rotary Club and meets men who are less likely to be exploitive and abusive. Third, we have the concept of the force or universal forces. This is a huge umbrella in that it can encompass the sci-fi concept of the force, as in Star Wars, or the idea of divine forces. Whether you tap into a universal force is partly a matter of faith and partly a matter of personal experience and whether you have found it fruitful for you. And fourth, we have beliefs as one of the most effective ways to change your life, which is something that Brett and I both focus on. I would note that it's not the only way. For example, some people may seek spiritual enlightenment and through that spiritual enlightenment get the results that they want. I do see these four factors as relatively independent of each other in that a person can strongly believe in one and only believe in another one of the factors a little bit or maybe even not at all. It doesn't need to be a package deal. You can pick and choose which of the factors make sense to you and which ones don't. So what can we make of conscious creation as a movement? Well, it's a big, big tent. It can accommodate God, and it can accommodate atheists. If you want a widespread movement, having a big tent is a great way to go. Further, it accommodates a very intellectual approach or a very New Age approach. For example, in the introduction of Brett's book, he talks about channeling people who have died. This would be quite a stretch for people who are very rationally minded, but very comfortable for people who are more New Age. Likewise, talking about alchemy is going to appeal to people who are more New Age. The conscious creation tent is big enough, however, to even accommodate somebody like Mr. Spock from Star Trek and his extremely rational approach to life. Conscious creation certainly got a big boost from Oprah giving so much attention to the movie The Secret. Bottom line, from my perspective, if it works for you, by all means, use it. If it just doesn't connect for you, find what does. Well, what can we make of the book Get the Picture? As Brett said, it's as much a philosophy book as it is a movie book. If you want to learn about conscious creation, this is a great way to do it because it pulls in movie examples as opposed to just talking about the philosophy abstractly. If you're looking for a more traditional movie critic book, as in Siskel and Ebert, you'll probably be frustrated by Get the Picture. Baby steps. I always like to leave you with some little tweak that you can make in your life, some little change that can help you live longer and healthier and happier. What I'd like you to do is think about your very favorite movie and ask yourself, what's the message in that movie? Why am I attracted to that movie? Is there something I'm trying to imitate from it, to learn from it? Is it addressing some issue that I'm struggling with? If it is, then tease all that you can out of it. Perhaps you can discuss it with some friends or family. Log onto the internet and see what the movie critics say about it. Or see if it's one of the couple hundred movies that Brett reviewed and get the picture. If you don't have one of those movies that's a favorite that connects for you, then try to identify what issue you're most concerned about in your life, what you'd most like to change in your life, and then look for what movies address that issue. If you're not sure, brainstorm it with a friend. When you pick the movie, take a good look at what kind of a role model the person is. What kind of belief shifts are going on? Is there a change in how the person views, quote, reality? If you're not sure, then talk about the movie with friends. Or even watch it with some friends and have a discussion about it. Emails. I love getting those emails. Most of the emails this week were about my interview with anti-aging physician Dr. Vincent Giampapa. And the gist of the emails was, do you really believe that we can test our genes and have the test results identify supplements that can turn on genes that would be healthy and turn off genes that cause aging or disease? It's a very complex question. Let me try to break it down. While scientists have the ability to test your genes, to test all of your genes would be extremely expensive, and for most of the genes, they really don't have the data to know what it means, much less what to do to intervene. Dr. Giampapa talked about five clusters, so he is focused on certain clusters of genes that are known to affect functionings like your cardiovascular system and metabolism. I think we're going to see more and more gene testing being available to lay people. Indeed, I recently heard on the radio an advertisement from one of our local hospitals in Columbus, Ohio, to come in and have your genes tested to screen for certain diseases. If you have any doubt how pervasive this is going to be, consider that you go down to your CVS drugstore and buy a kit that will let you test to see whether you're the father of a child and mail in the DNA sample to find out. So we have several types of genetic testing going on. We have testing for a specific disease that you're at risk for, testing for several diseases that you might be at risk for, DNA testing in criminal cases, anti-aging screening, which is what Dr. Giampapa was talking about, and now even paternity testing. In theory, Dr. Giampapa's system makes sense and can work. In practice, there are so many details that I don't know about it that I can't say. However, I do plan on looking into it in far more depth and trying it out myself, and at some future date, I'll report back to you. This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net. If you like the kind of advice you're getting, be sure to sign up for the Defy Aging newsletter. It's free. All you have to do is go to drbricky.com or agelesslifestyles.com and sign up. I'd love to get your emails. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. And I thank you for letting me be your coach and your guide in our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.